Book of Esther. I was just checking for the... Although I've got at the beginning there that the dates could be anything between, as you can see, 460 and 330. In fact, of course, when it was actually written and then published is almost impossible to tell. But the period it comes from is around about 48 something, which would be the dates of Ahasuerus. And it's about 480, 460, somewhere around there. Obviously, the author would have been a Jew, and it's remarkable, as I'm sure most of you know, because there doesn't seem to be the name of God anywhere in the book. This led to all sorts of negative things about Esther, plus the fact that it's the only book it appears, that is not quoted in the New Testament. And if you look at Hebrews in chapter 11 for a minute, it may not be quoted, but I think there's probably an allusion to Esther when they were saved from the hand of their enemies and they subdued the kingdom of Persia, which really was, of course, quite something. And you will see in chapter 11 of Hebrews, verse 32, "And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell you of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of the fire, escaped the edge of the sword." Now, a number of things there that Esther would demonstrate. "From weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight." For instance, the story by their release from Persia and their overcoming their enemies. One, they in a sense conquered a kingdom edict. They performed an act of righteousness. They vindicated the Jews in their position. That's what they actually say. They obtained promises. Shut the mouths of lions. Obviously next door, well not quite next door, but next door in time, events like the story of Daniel. Quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and they escaped the edge of the sword. From weakness were made strong. Well, that couldn't be a better demonstration than the weakness of the Jews at that time, and the weakness indeed that Esther feels in her interceding on behalf of the Jews. Well, there are a number of clear statements there that could apply to the book of Esther. So I wouldn't say that it is totally without any suggestion at all that Esther has something to say. But the opposition to Esther has been quite remarkable over the years. I know that Luther, who threw out the Epistle of James, well, he was complained bitterly that the book of Esther ever came down to us, he said. I think again because of the defence and the use of the sword, but he did enough against others, but there you are. There were others that he would also claim were on his side. For instance, Athanasius didn't like this book, along with one of the Gregory of Nazianzus, one of the Cappadocian fathers. They didn't particularly like it in the days when they were arguing about the canon. At least Calvin kept it in his list, but it's one of the few books he didn't write a commentary on. Every other book of the Bible Calvin wrote on. So up until today, a lot of people have been very negative. However, we are not negative about any of the Bible books, are we?
No,
we're not. That's the right response. And I believe it's there for a purpose. And the purpose is not just simply, as lots of people have done, as I've given a little hint at the back, how it can be used as a kind of typology, a kind of metaphors of the spiritual Christian life, or sometimes just as an example of switching it round instead of interceding with Ahasuerus, but interceding to God, and it's been used to demonstrate that sort of thing. But strictly speaking, that is not what the text is saying to us. The text is there to show us how the Jews were delivered. They were God's people. They are still, as it were, in business, despite the fact they're in exile. So God hasn't given up totally on them. There's been no rescinding of the old covenant and its promises. So there is a sense in which whatever it is that's written here about them is likely to have bearing upon the purpose that God chose them for and where they're going, especially in a time of exile. Now, it's interesting that the previous two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, are a kind of a duo, showing the value of returning from the exile and re-establishing the altar, the temple, and the wall of the city. That's all very instructive, and it's got lots of prophecies tied up with it and so on. But when we get to this last book of the historical ones, the book of Esther, we're still in exile, well and truly bound down there. And as most of you, I'm quite sure, are well aware, basically the 10 tribes are lost and seem to be lost forever. There aren't many opportunities to pick up the story or the history again. It was only that small group that came back and rebuilt Jerusalem, and the land of Judah and the city-state of Judah started to come into being. So this is just a word for the Jews who've been left out there, you might say, in the lurch, in the exile, and probably choosing themselves not to come back. A lot of them didn't want to go back into the and pick up the story, and that would generally mean they want to go and pick up what God was doing. So even though the return from the exile was pretty unimpressive, yet nonetheless it was where the purpose and the plan of God was going to be fulfilled and Jesus was going to be born. So these are people who are left outside in the dispersion of the Jews. They have synagogues in every place. They are going to be very important when it comes to world evangelization, because as the apostles go out from Judea, Jerusalem, they go to the synagogues, and they go to the synagogues of the dispersion. And you see Peter writing to the diaspora, to the dispersion. And this is showing you, even in the Old Testament days, that a bit of the dispersion still had God's thoughts, still God was keeping an eye on them. I've still got a purpose for you, even though they're not in the forefront of the things that God is doing. So this is a Jew, a resident in a Persian city called Mordecai, and Mordecai has a niece called Esther, and Esther is going to take the place of the queen. The style of the book is quite clearly a historical record. It's not meant to be a timeless parable that hangs around to show us spiritual truths. It was meant to be a history book. Now, it came to pass, is the way it begins. And fourthly, in the introduction there, the purpose of the book, one, to answer the post-exilic question, was God with them? Seems very unlikely that he was with them. This was a judgment anyway. And here they were abandoned and they didn't really have any opportunity. Very difficult to implement the Torah. And incidentally, I told you the bad press that the Christian church has given the book of Esther. Very good press from the Jews. In the 11th century, Maimonides, I think is the way you pronounce him, he said that the Torah and the book of Esther, even if all the other books of the Bible perished, would last forever. It did, and there are apparent nuanced allusions to Genesis in Esther, but I won't go into those. I think only perhaps the Jewish commentators can discover those, but they are apparently there. The only book of the Bible not to mention God. That's why it's got a bad press. Neither does it mention prayer. But both of these, we'll see, are actually implied. It mentions, of course, fasting, and it also, hidden away in the text, has got the name Yahweh. The name Yahweh, translated Lord. So there are four acrostics written into the text which reveal the name Lord or Yahweh. The secret, or at least the unspoken name of God, which is too awesome even to mention, Yahweh, from the verb to be. The literal translation of the Hebrew is given first in the text here, and you'll see the way I've put it out in English, that shows how it appears in the Hebrew text as a kind of, anagram, not quite an anagram, a play on the words. Esther 1:20, 5:4, 5:13, and 7-7. The same old problem still going on way back in those days. The very delicate and sensitive ego of men feels that somehow it's being put down and trampled over. So they've got to have a law to put their wives in the right place. Well, now, here's the little bit of poetry. You've got it in your text. Due respect, our ladies all shall give their husbands great and small. Well, that's roughly what it says, wasn't it? Well, here it is in poetry, and I picked up the D, due respect to our ladies. And you've got Lord spelt backwards or forwards, depending on whether you want to read it in Hebrew or you want to read it in English. 5:4. So here it is put into poetry. Let our royal dinner bring Haman feasting with the king. Did you like that? Well, you've got L-O-R-D the other way round as the first letters. Verse 3. None of this avails me. I can't bear it if I see him sitting in the gate. Grand for no avail. As D-R-O-L, the Hebrew way round. My state while this Jew sits in the gate. Do you like this book? And here's another one hidden in number 4. Now that translates, or it alliterates into the poetry of ill to fear decreed, I find towards me in the monarch's mind. I think we've missed a bit out there somewhere. Ill to fear decreed, I find towards me in the monarch's mind. So those very free translations convey for us Lord backwards and forwards, first letters and last letters. Indeed, there are a couple of other places where you get Yahweh built into the actual words used in the 5th chapter and 6th chapter, I think it is. We won't look any more, but that does in a sense illustrate the purpose and the message of this book. That outwardly, yes, the name of God is not used. Prayer doesn't take place. But they do fast, and they do find that God is at work, hidden in the warp and woof of what's going on. So that is the kind, it sums up the message of the book, and it's so good, I think it's not to be missed. Because that surely is the reason why a book like this is found in the Bible. It's to encourage us that when we can't see what God's doing, we can't see his at work, it looks all hopeless and useless. God is in working all things according to the counsel of his will. And is still going to win the game of chess. He's working all the machinations that are taking place by God's enemies. Another characteristic of this book are its duplications. There are three groups of banquets that come in pairs, two prepared by Ahasuerus, two prepared by Esther, and two celebrations of Purim. Now, Purim was a very popular feast amongst the Jews. It wasn't one of the original three that God commanded they should come up three times a year to the place he chose and there to worship. But this is a nonetheless, because it was celebrating the release from captivity that the children of Israel went through, and they kept the Feast of Purim. There are four, I think, altogether extra feasts that they put on, which you read about in Zechariah, but they weren't the God-ordained ones, and this wasn't a God-ordained one, but it does emphasize the two celebrations of Purim. Then there are two lists of the king's servants, two reports that Esther concealed her identity, two gatherings of women. There are a lot of twos all over the book, and it is one of the characteristics. Two feasts. You've got all the verses there you can look up if you want to compare them or talk about them in a message. Two consultations of Haman with his wife and friends. Haman, of course, is the enemy, and is the one who is all the time trying to get Mordecai finished off. He was trying to get him hung, and he gets in the end hung on his own gallows, which is a very, very poetic ending. But evil is like that. It finishes you off in the end. So it's not just nicely poetic, and it's the way that God's wrath is at work bringing about this kind of poetic justice. Two scheduled appearances of Esther before the king, two occasions when Mordecai is honoured. He's honoured when it comes to the king that he's not been rewarded for his faithfulness. And then he's honoured at the end of the story. Two coverings of Haman's face, it says. Royal edicts twice, references to the subsidising of the king's anger. References to the irrevocability of the Persian laws. You don't change the laws of the Medes and Persians. 2 days for the Jews to take vengeance when they were going to be put down. 2 letters instituting the commemoration of Purim. And 2 portions given, one to Esther and one to the poor. It's probably the simplest way of seeing its structure is by this pattern that I've put down here. First and foremost, there's the opening and background of the book in chapter 1, which balances with the epilogue, where the Jews have been victorious. The king's first decree is in chapters 2 and 3. The king's second decree is in chapters 8 and 9. The clash between Haman and Mordecai, because Haman can't abide this Jew who won't bow down to him, is balanced by Mordecai's triumph over Haman. And in the middle of the book is this one verse, chapter 6, verse 1, kind of like the middle of the story, where the king did not sleep. That again, we are meant to read in that God kept him awake. It was because of something that was going on either in his digestion or in his conscience that kept him awake, so that he read the book and he was reminded of what Mordecai had done for him. So that's the first part up to chapter 6, verse 1. They're in mortal danger. And the final part, salvation comes. The crisis point where everybody's on tenterhooks. What's going to happen in this story? What's he going to read? He reads something else and he gets the answer. So it's quite a dramatic presentation in the whole story. So it isn't just to be dismissed like Luther seems to think it ought to be. The characters in this bit of play, because it's like a play, drama. Ahasuerus is the famous Xerxes. Xerxes the First. There's his dates, which I was looking for, 484 to 465. So the story is set at that period, the end of, well, nearly the end of the 5th century. And there's Ezra in chapter 4, verse 6, mentioning the emperor of Persia. Vashti is the rejected queen of Xerxes. I've sometimes done marriage seminars and use Vashti as an interesting subject, because you remember in the story, don't you, he demands that, but they've all been drinking for an awful long time, I think it goes on for a week or so, and so he's probably in a pretty bad way, and in his drunken stupor is probably insulting his wife, or intending to, by calling that she should come out, that they may see her beauty and all the rest of it. And the fact is, Vashti might have in some way cooperated and then told him off when they get home in the bedroom, that you never do that again to me, kind of thing. That's one way of coping with it. But she decides to say, no, I'm not going to indulge in this kind of drunken orgy like this. And so she disobeys her husband, which makes all the men there fearful. What's he going to do? So the king thinks he's got to really put this woman down. He gets rid of her and says, I'm going to have another queen. He probably had thoughts in that direction already, so I wouldn't take it too seriously. But no doubt he was getting his own back on her. So I've used this as an example of how you just don't treat one another. You husbands, you do not do that sort of thing to your wife, and wives do not publicly shame their husbands. Isn't there another way of resolving this one? She could say, I'm sorry, my dear, I'll come another night, but not tonight, got a headache or something, and perhaps resolve the situation a little better than they go about it. So it is dishonouring one another in marriage like this publicly is so often done, and not the way in which God intends to exercise our lives together. Esther means star, and she's going to be the new queen, and she's a Jewess. She doesn't reveal that at first. She's also called Hadashah, or Hadashah, and the Hebrew means myrtle. It's sometimes people think myrtle stood for Israel. You get the riders in the myrtle bushes, you remember in the book of Zechariah. It's certainly possible that she would represent Israel. After all, she is now going to be the queen of the emperor who rules over Israel. She is the cousin or a niece and relative to Mordecai, who in those days, like it is in the East still today, every woman in somewhere or other comes under the authority of a man, and that means under his protection, to put it in a better bow for Westerners. Haman is the prime minister. He's descended from Agag. Well, if you read Genesis 36:12 and Exodus 17:8-16 there on your notes, and 1 Samuel 15, Agag was a survivor from a group who had attacked Israel and were commanded to be removed. And so we might think it wasn't very merciful, or it wasn't very kind, or it was didn't matter, just one left over. But in the end, it's that line that is causing the trouble, and Haman is causing the disturbance. So it may be not something that immediately is affecting us, but God is working out something it's going to be for the future. Obedience is more important than sacrifice. Knowledge of God more than burnt offering. Now Mordecai was a Benjaminite, and he was descended from Shimei. Look at 2 Samuel 16 and 19 about Shimei. Don't forget, Saul was a Benjaminite, and he'd been replaced by David. David is coming under attack from Absalom. And 2 Samuel 16, can you see Shimei mentioned there? Now in chapter 19, David says, God has probably told him to curse, so leave him alone. So the background of Shimei's family is not a particularly encouraging one, and yet he becomes a hero. So we are not totally governed by our inheritance or our genes. Themes: feasting and fasting. The story is built around three sets of two feasts. Esther's call to fast is the turning point. Power of agreement, chapter 1, chapter 5, and the kingdom agreements, chapter 4. Esther is a kind of new Moses, mediator and lawgiver. There are allusions to the Torah and to Genesis, but to the Torah itself and to Moses. The Amalekite threat is thwarted. Right, don't look at the appendix yet. Just turn now, you've already turned, I hope, to the book of Esther. Have a quick run through. I should have said also, not only no God, no prayer, but there's no worship in the book either. Very strange to some people, but I think as we've seen, it's nonetheless still a very important book. Now, it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, who reigned in India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, and in those days King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne as in Susa, his capital. Third year of his reign gave a banquet, and it went on, verse 4, for many days. Can you see how many? It's unbelievable, isn't it? Yeah, but you'll read some researchers who've come across similar sorts of things in these ancient chronicles, so it's not to be dismissed as fantasy. Well, it shows that, partying is supposed to be a good thing, I should imagine. He displayed the riches and of his royal glory, etc. And when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet, just in case there was anybody left over, lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Susa, the capital, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And it tells us a bit of the luxury that existed there. And verse 9, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And the seventh day there, and the 77 eunuchs who served the presence of King Ahasuerus. Verse 14, those who were close to him are mentioned by name. Verse 13, then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king to speak before all who knew law and justice, about, of course, what had happened in verse 12. King Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry and his wrath burned within him. Verse 20, when the king's edict, which would make, was heard throughout his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honour to their husbands, great and small. And this word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed, sent letters to the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, and every man should be master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. Chapter 2, he now starts to say, well, I need a queen, and it's fascinating all the things that Esther goes through, keeping quiet her Jewish identity. And Mordecai is introduced to us in verse 11, and every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. She's rather devoted, of course, to his cousin or niece or whatever. Now when the turn of each young lady came to go to King Ahasuerus, right, and then it went through all that process. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, verse 16, to his royal palace in the 10th month and the 7th day of his reign. Verse 19, and when the virgins were gathered together in the second time, then Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. And Esther had not made known her kindred to her of her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials, those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. The plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be, they were hanged on a gallows. So the gallows starts to appear in the story. It's going to appear again. Look at gallows in chapter 5, verse 14. Then Jairus, his wife, and all his friends said to him, that is, to Haman, have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Then again in verse 4 of chapter 6, hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. He's looking forward to this. Then verse 9 of chapter 7. Behold indeed the gallows standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. So they hanged Haman on the gallows. Verse 7 of chapter 8. They hanged on the gallows because he had stretched out his hand against the Jews, Haman. And that, I believe, over in chapter 9 and verse 13. And then finally, in verse 25, but when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme which he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that his son should be hanged on the gallows. So the gallows, or the tree, as it often is translated, especially in that last case there, would be the Hebrew word, of course, that would be used for the cross, for the crucifixion. It's the gallows, the gibbet, the stake where Christ was crucified. And that is the place of vindication and justice, of course. It's where we're vindicated and we're justified. And where, if you like, the whole issue of God's Justice, Theodicy, which is up for grabs, where God's vindication takes place, is at the cross. And we can't find any answer or get any answer to the way that God governs the universe unless we see he does it through the cross. Well, after all, it's got King written on it, King of the Jews. And he does still have nail-pierced hands to demonstrate that the hands of authority on the earth are those that have been through the cross. The cross is the means whereby God is bringing the whole universe into order in such a way that it's redeemed and that justice is maintained. So the whole forensic aspect of the cross is rooted into different pictures and ways not to be just discarded, because it doesn't fit modern man too well, according to some people's opinion. So Esther supports or gives background understanding of that kind of that size of the theology of the atonement. In chapter 3, letters were sent to couriers of the king's provinces to destroy and annihilate all the Jews, both young, old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. This is not imagination. This has been done many times. It's been done in this country. Some appalling ways in which the revenue was brought in by Edward I for funding the Crusades. It was to afflict the Jews in this kind of manner and find ways in which they could be relieved of their property and money. A short period, there was a refuge in England. Under Henry III was not so anti-Jewish, but his son Edward was terrible, and so were others. And it's been done throughout Europe. Pogroms, of course, have continued on even into the 20th century. It's a sad and terrible thing that absolutely, totally, completely and utterly nothing to do with the crucifixion of Christ, and to imagine or make up the story that they would be such culprits is simply out of the clever imagination of people who just want to exploit them and make use of them, which is what's going on here, and it's happened many times since. So they went out and everybody's ready for the murder of the Jews on a particular day. Everybody getting ready for it. There was fasting, weeping, wailing, many in sackcloth and ashes, verse 3, which of course is towards God, even though he's not mentioned. Do fast towards God. You don't wear sackcloth and ashes just for the fun of it. You do it, as it were, to represent your condition before the Lord. It's interesting that you get that little phrase in chapter 5, verse 3, where it says, "And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be given to you." Now, of course, we know it's a quaint way of saying, "Ask what you want." But it was the one, it comes again in verse 6, "Even to half the kingdom it shall be done to you." Do you remember that this is John the Baptist's head was at stake on this one? Ask for half the kingdom. Because the answer to Herod was, "Yeah, yes, but John the Baptist's head is in the other half of the kingdom." So, but he didn't think of that one. He wanted to keep face in front of all his courtiers, and so he allowed the execution, although he didn't really want it, to go ahead for the sake of his wife Herodias, who had been criticized also by John the Baptist. Chapter 6, verse 1 is, as I said, the turning point. "During that night the king could not sleep." And this presumably is to be understood that God is keeping him awake and nudging him. "So he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. It was found written that Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, and they'd sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus." Now, first of all, he's inconvenienced, he can't go to sleep, so he brings in a book. It happens to be, God's name is to be seen in this, just like it's hidden. His name is hidden in the text. God is at work hidden in these events. And what's been done for this? I mean, he might just have ignored that as well. Why should he do anything for his servants who were faithful to him? Mind you, it's a good policy, but he didn't have to do anything. "So the king said, 'Who is in the court? Who is in the court?' And Now Haman had just entered the outer court, the king's palace. Behold, Haman is standing in the court, and the king said, "Let him come in." And Haman came to the king. "What is to be done to the man whom the king has to honor?" Haman said to him, "Oh, you to honor the man more than me." And so that's what he thought. And Haman said, "For the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe, and a horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown should be placed, etc., 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 and take him through the streets, declaring or proclaiming, 'Thus it shall be done to the man who he desires to honor.'" Well, of course, the poetic justice is it all then turns out to be his enemy, which we all like story. It's like a pantomime story, but it's good, and we can enjoy it. And there's no reason why God shouldn't work in that way to get his will done. A little bit of dishonor might have done Haman some good, but I'm afraid it doesn't seem to. The king said to Haman, "Take now the robes and so on, and do that very thing that you said to Mordecai," who's his enemy. When Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home mourning with his head covered. Verse 12. Chapter 7. Half the kingdom comes up again in verse 2. And what happens is, on chapter 8, well, the king's anger, of course, is brought against against Haman, but I'm looking for where it says they stood their ground and they protected themselves. They were allowed, the edict was not rescinded, because it was one of, you don't rescind the Medes and Persians laws, but they stand their ground with their swords. Verse 5 of chapter 9, "Thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword." Remember, they subdued kingdoms with the sword. They struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. And in Susa, the capital, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, etc., etc. And the salvation comes through this particular means, which the king allows them to operate. But he doesn't rescind the actual edict, because he can't. And in chapter 10, verse 1, King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the accomplishments of his authority and strength, and all the full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him. Are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and in favor with the multitude and the people, very much like Daniel, who rose up in the ranks, also went down again, went up and down, but God preserved him. And he looked after the welfare, or the salvation, the shalom of the whole nation. Just a quick glance at the appendix. We are looking at the idea of Christ dwelling in us. Esther's intercession, verse chapter 5. That's Christ interceding in us, witnessing. She declares who she is. She witnesses to Christ, we would say to Christ in, is deliverance and peace. I had a rundown on this at one time. It's a long time ago, from an old friend of mine who's long since dead, but he actually worked it out in such a way that he got some Pentecostal doctrine out of the book of Esther, which is interesting. But you can discuss what sanctification, consecration, Christ praying in us, interceding, witnessing, Christ witnessing and speaking through us, and then the joy of the life in the Lord, which is our strength. The joy of the Lord is our strength. So the indwelling Christ can be spelled out from the book in that kind of way. The way he used it was, Christ in us is Esther, whereas Christ upon us in the Spirit would have been Mordecai. But I don't necessarily advocate that. I was just pointing out that such things have been done. And it's also, you'll find the emphasis on Christ's life in us coming out in a little booklet that Ian Thomas, Major Ian Thomas, he wrote a little commentary on the book of Esther, all built around his great theme, which he always preached, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. and it would be a bit similar to like I've laid it out there. But that kind of typology is not very popular these days, but it's been done. You might like to do it, I don't mind. Standing the ground, finding God, working in secret, hidden away, getting His will done, is a great evocation of faith for us to believe when we feel quite the reverse.